So, last class, I believe we concluded with the lemma that the position and momentum operators are self-adjoint. One of you came to see me after a class and was asking about some issues from Reed and Simon. So I was talking about L2R, whereas the issue you were concerned with there are some subtle issues if one tries to construct self-adjoint extensions on a bounded domain. Which we're not going to concern ourselves with. So now the goal is we want to justify a kind of spectral decomposition for infinite for unbounded operators. We went through the trouble of showing that the position and momentum operators are self-adjoint so that we could, are self-adjoint because we can have such a spectral theorem for self-adjoint unbounded operators. Yes?
We've seen characteristics of the position and momentum operator that make them a little troublesome, but what precisely do you mean in this case by unbounded operator?
It means that the range of the eigenvalues is not a bounded range. I didn't give a definition of unbounded operators, did I? Yeah, I think I can give you one. Or I think I can give you a better. So we can define the operator norm of an operator A as the supremum over all normalized vectors, and you look at the action of A on a vector. And that defines its norm. Operator norm, sometimes called its infinity norm. And then operator is unbounded if this norm is infinite. The least upper bound. So it's basically the maximum, but it deals with continuous values. So it's the least upper bound. So the position and momentum operators are unbounded and also self-adjoint, which means, remember the difference between Hermitian and self-adjoint, and this is probably the kind of most basic message, is that Hermitian is weaker than self-adjoint. To be self-adjoint, the operator has to be Hermitian, and also the domain of A and the domain of A adjoint have to be the same. And that's the kind of tricky part. So I warned the students last class that the mathematics involved in this is kind of...
I won't select you.
Oh, you do? Yeah, it's arbitrarily involved, and so it depends how much you love, you know, mathematics in terms of how far you want to go with this. But so we have to introduce now notions of measures, and I suspect that many of you have not seen measure theory. But so what I'll do is I'll just make use of these concepts, and perhaps some of the ones that need further elaboration could be covered in the tutorial. So we're going to define a projector-valued function, E. On the sigma algebra of the measure space is called a spectral measure. If E acting on the full set is identity, and if A1, A2, all the way up to, well, some collection of sets are disjoint subsets in the sigma algebra, then the projector-valued function E evaluated on the union of those sets is just the sum of the function evaluated on each set, the sum of the projectors. Yes?
How about a projector-valued function and measure space?
The definitions?
Or sense of them?
So a projector-valued function is basically a projector, which you've seen. So a projector is something the square of which is equal to itself, and it also has to be self-adjoint. But we're going to allow it to depend on a continuous parameter. So traditionally, we've looked at projectors onto subspaces, and we've defined projectors onto bases of a subspace. So we've had a countable index for the projectors. But what we're working towards is a notion of a projector which has a continuous index. That's what a projector valued function E is. And then a sigma algebra is basically, if you think about, for example, you can have an example of a measure space is you would have omega equal to, say, the real line. So the space omega represents operationally what this means for us is that when we have a measurement, like a measurement of position, we have a continuous set of outcomes which are given by the position eigenvalues. And the position eigenvalues are just real numbers, and similarly for momentum. And they're real numbers in the range minus infinity to plus infinity. And then the sigma algebra A, what that is we look at, remember that when we're talking about probabilistic events, the probability of any one number in the real line is zero. The probability of getting any one real number as an outcome is zero. For Hilbert space vectors at least, maybe not for the Dirac delta function, but that's not a Hilbert space vector is the whole point. So typically what you define is an interval. And so the idea of the sigma algebra is to define the set of kind of well-defined intervals. So what's the Borel measure? It's the set of open sets on, anyways, well, all right. So think of A as the set of intervals AB on the real line. Does that help? So the idea is we want to associate some kind of projector-valued function with the different intervals. So I'm going to be, say, measuring whether or not the position particle is found between A and B on the real line. And then I want to have some way of calculating what the probability of finding that, finding the quantum value to be within that interval is. Yes? Oh, thank you. Thanks for catching that. Now here's where we introduce the continuous index. A projector valued function E lambda for lambda some real number is called a spectral family if for lambda less than or equal to lambda prime, E lambda is less than or equal to E lambda prime. In the limit that epsilon goes to 0, the projector E lambda plus epsilon is equal to E lambda. In the limit that lambda goes to minus infinity, E lambda is equal to the zero operator. And in the limit that lambda goes to plus infinity, E lambda is just the identity operator on the Hilbert space. So this introduces a well-defined notion of ordering. So essentially the idea is we're ordering projections onto the set of states which have eigenvalues lambda less than or equal to some number. And then we want this family to satisfy reasonable properties, a continuity condition, as well as the fact that it kind of gives us the full Hilbert space when we take the full range of lambdas. Yes?
So when we compare E lambda and E lambda prime, do we use the operator, I mean, they're operators, right? So they use the,
Yeah, so typically what this means is that for all psi is less than or equal to e lambda prime psi.
The defendant is a positive operator.
Yeah, exactly. So these limits are defined in a strong sense, which I don't think we need to get into, but just be aware that that's the case. And then finally, we have the spectral theorem. To each self-adjoint operator, what am I calling it here? Let's call it R. On a Hilbert space H, corresponds a unique spectral family E sub lambda for lambda some real parameter such that the domain of R is equal to all psi in the Hilbert space, the integral over lambda squared d psi d lambda psi is finite, and for all psi in the domain and for all phi in the Hilbert space, we have that phi, the inner product of phi with R acting on psi is equal to the integral of lambda, and this measure, e lambda psi. Okay, so let me unpack this for you a bit. So this is the theorem of von Neumann that allows us to avoid Dirac's rigged Hilbert space trick and actually discuss, actually treat the position and momentum operators within the Hilbert space formalism at the cost of introducing some fairly involved mathematics. From my point of view, there are various subtleties in these issues. For example, as I mentioned earlier, that if the Hilbert space isn't L2R but some bounded interval, then there's no unique self-adjoint, and one has to find self-adjoint extensions. And this is a active area. I can refer you to Reed and Simon, which is a great book on functional analysis that covers these issues in depth. But these problems come up in fields like quantum field theory and curved space-time, where one has to treat these issues systematically. From the point of view of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, this is just a lot of overhead that allows us to write down formulas we were already using. So depending on what level of understanding you're going for, you can accept this at different levels. Right, I was about to give you that. So first let me write this down. All right, I'll give you the Stieltjes integral. So by the way, so almost everything I introduce as defined is can be defined in terms of other things that you won't recognize as being defined, and this becomes an infinite regress until you understand all of mathematics. So we're gonna have to kind of cut this off at some point because it's just not that relevant. But let me at least give you that, and then you guys, the Stieltjes integral. Oh, there it is. Okay. So we can define an operator A in the following way. And then that symbolic notation for if you have psi A phi, that's equal to the integral over R lambda d psi E lambda phi. And then you'll ask, well, what does that mean? And then the answer is it's defined in terms of a Stieltjes integral. So here, integration is a, how do you spell this guy's name? Where is that? Stieltjes. Where the integral over lambda dE lambda is equal to the limit as n goes to infinity of a sum over k equals 1 to n of lambda k e lambda k minus e lambda k minus 1. So the upshot of this, the upshot is this. We can talk about the probability, this is the Born rule now, the probability that lambda is in some interval a, b, has a well-defined mathematical meaning as being an integral. So it's psi integral over a, b, d, e, lambda, psi. And similarly, given some, and then given, so once we have, so which result. And then we also have for some function of, what did I call it, R over there? For some function of R, which is a self-adjoint operator, we can write integral over lambda. So I'm switching between R and A as my operator, Paul. I'm combining notes from two sources, so it's, well, I guess that's just in general, that's what that means. And now R is an instance of A, some self-adjoint operator. So we can talk about the function of a self-adjoint operator in this way, by just taking the function evaluating on the scalar and then doing the integral as before in terms of the Stieltjes integral. Let me give you an example. For the position operator, so for the position operator Q, we know it's self-adjoint, and its action on a vector is just equal to scalar multiplication for some Q in the real line. So it has a dense domain, and we can define the spectral family associated with this self-adjoint unbounded operator is Q of A acting on psi is equal to the theta function of A minus X acting on psi. Theta function and then we have Q acting on psi, remember here, sorry, psi of X is an element of L2R. We have the integral over the real line of A dQ of A. So now A is playing the role of lambda in the previous, in the general discussion. And this is equal via Stieltjes to be this limit of the sum for k equals 1 to n of AK acting on Q. Whoops. Change the notation here, QAK minus Q AK minus 1. Make sure my operator Qs are hatted. Acting on psi of X, which is just equal to X psi of X. Was that a stretch or a question? I guess that was a stretch. Yes?
The second line of the example, do you mean Q hat psi equals X psi?
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so this is pretty heavy-handed. This involves a lot of mathematics, which you haven't been exposed to, and I don't really expect you to have a kind of a profound grasp on. The point of this lecture was a bit different in the sense that the idea was really just to give you a flavor of the issues involved rather than really go through it in detail. And so, yeah.
When you define FR,
yeah.
Or integration of a lambda,
mm-hmm.
What does this mean? Because the standard integral is integral of R.
Oh.
Right.
So R is equal to, no, this is analogous to here.
Yeah.
So you're evaluating overall lambda in R. Where this R is the real, those two vertical bars here. Sorry if the, is that visible? Yeah, okay. Oh, I just written lambda there. Yeah, okay. All right, so if unless there are other questions, but yeah, so I'd encourage you, by the way, so a very good reference for understanding these things more deeply is Reed and Simon's comprehensive four-volume set. Actually, does anyone, do you remember the name of their...
Introduction to functional analysis.
Introduction to functional analysis. Yeah, see volumes 1 through 4 on functional analysis. You know, so these are, I have my own personal point of view, because in my own personal research work, these issues never come up. And so this is stuff that I only understand at a very kind of superficial level. And I'm kind of conveying to you that superficial level of understanding. But these are very practical issues when you do a much more involved version of quantum mechanics. If you do quantum field theory on curved space-time, things like that, then these issues come up all the time. And dealing with how to define rigorously the operators you want to work with. Yeah?
Could you help us understand why the special family in the example of the position operator should be realized as the theta function? My very naive initial thought would be delta function, because it's what I'm used to associating with position function.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, so well, so basically, I guess the intuitive idea here is instead of talking about delta functions, which are pick out a point on the real line, the idea is to think about it as differences between operators which pick out all points up to lambda, and another projector which picks out all points up to lambda plus epsilon, and then your delta function lives heuristically in that interval of lambda plus epsilon minus lambda. So you look at the cumulative projectors and look at differences between them, and that's the spirit of the approach. So thanks for that question. I should have said that. So yeah, if you don't want to worry about the details, that's kind of the heuristic idea. But I'd like to move on to path integrals now, if that's okay with everyone. So the idea is the path integral formulation is a distinct formulation of quantum mechanics. It was devised by Feynman. Let's see if I can get the date here. So the what Feynman did is actually assume something called the Markov property, which we'll see shortly, and built up this path integral formulation and then derived the Schrodinger equation from his point of view. So he had a different kind of axiomatic approach to constructing quantum mechanics or quantum dynamics. What we're going to do is just discuss the Markov property so you understand what that is, and then we're going to use the Schrodinger picture to derive the path integral formulation. So consider a set of sequential measurements. So here, this is okay. Now, let's look at the. Let's look first at classical probability. So we have some variable of interest, and what we're going to do is measure that variable at successive times. So we measure some quantity A and get result little a, and then we measure some quantity B and get result little b, and sorry, these are sequential in time. And then we measure some quantity C and get outcome little c. And we're interested in the probability that big C equals little c, given that we had outcome little a for the measurement of big A. So this is called a conditional probability, and it's denoted P of C given A. So we have the marginalization rule of classical probability. Which is that the probability of C given A is equal to summing over all intermediate values B we could have had, and looking at the probability of C and B given A. And we also have the product rule of classical probability, which is that the probability of C and B given A is equal to the probability of C given B and A, and the probability of B given A. Now, this is true in general, but now we can make a simplifying assumption. Suppose that some outcome B gives a complete specification of the state. Of the state of the system. So this is the Markov assumption, or the Markov property, which mathematically states that the probability of C given B and A is just equal to the probability of C given B. So what that means is that B kind of screens off A, and that once you know what B is, you have everything you need to know about the probability of outcome C. Your information about what A was is irrelevant now. So this is clearly the case in classical dynamics. So if I know the position and momentum at some time t, I can predict, not only probabilistically, but deterministically, what the position and momentum will be at a later time. I don't need to know, in addition to the position and momentum at time of the measurement B, I don't also need to know the position and momentum at an earlier time. That's additional information that's superfluous. So who knows of an example of a system where the history matters prior to the instant B? Hysteresis, yeah, that's the kind of paradigmatic example of hysteresis, where the system has some memory of where it was, and so its state at the current time isn't enough to determine its state at a later time. So given the Markov property, so combining our laws of probability with the Markov property, or the Markov assumption, we get that the probability of C given A is just equal to the sum over B, probability of C given B times the probability of B given A. So now the probability of C given A involves just a sum over intermediate values B and in this product. So now we consider a large number of successive measurements and we have the probability of K given A is equal to sum over J, sum over C, sum over B, P of K given J, P of C given B, and P of B given A. And now we can imagine switching to a continuous set of possible outcomes. So we generalize this to continuous outcomes, and the sums become integrals. We have the probability of xk given x naught is equal to the integral of d xk minus 1, integral of dx2, integral of dx1, p of xk given xk minus 1, all the way down to P of x2 given x1 and P of x1 given x0. Okay, so this is this is called a path integral. And is interpreted as a sum over paths. And here we're using the word sum in a very loose sense. And it can be expressed symbolically in a much more compact form. P of x given x naught, we introduce this notation, d of x of t p of x of t given x naught.
Second line
from the top. Yes, there. Yeah. What are the first indices? P of, yeah, what are those things? Well, it's P of xk given xk minus 1. Sorry, my subscript font is too small, I think. No problem. So now what we're going to do now is generalize this formula we've already generalized it to continuous variables, but now we're going to generalize it from probabilities to quantum complex amplitudes and use the same principle to derive the quantum path integral. Yeah, Deepa?
How do you pick x1 to xk? Are they discrete sets?
We're not picking them. We're integrating over all possibilities.
So you're given x not to xk.
Oh, I'm sorry. Here, let me show you a picture. So the idea is that you have some interval which divide up from x0, x1, x2, all the way up to xk. Sorry, divide it up into t0, t1, t2, all the way up to tk. And then you start out initially at time x0, and you're going to end up, so this is position x versus time, you're going to end up at some position xk. And then what we're imagining is there's a whole bunch of different paths, which are these kind of zigzag paths, which are going to, which have to be constrained at the boundaries. So the boundaries are fixed. But then we imagine all possible trajectories that take you from x0 to xk in these increments. And the continuous one is this limit where we take t0 goes to t1, the delta t goes to 0. Is there? Yeah.
So sometimes the name Wiener measure is associated with the kind of path integral. Is that relation to that or no?
So, is that the what?
Sometimes the Wiener measure is also associated with the Markov process represented as half integral, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I guess I'm not going to connect to that, though.
Okay, so this is not this is more general. So.
Yeah, I don't remember the specific definition of a Wiener process, but it's very similar. It's very similar. What is that again? Okay, so it's connect with the quantum setting. Remember, we have, if we have some wave function psi of x of t, we can express this in the following form as a propagator g of xt x prime t naught acting on psi at x prime t naught dx prime, where g of xt x prime t naught is equal to x, it's the position representation of the unitary operator. So here g is called the propagator. And it's just the position, so we're just, basically what we're doing is we're working in the position representation now. So now we imagine divide the interval t t naught t naught t into what's my index here into n small time steps of size delta t. And then u of with this notation, I guess, u of tn, let's just make this t1 for now. So the unitary propagator, of course, decomposes as tn, tn minus 1 times u, tn, tn minus 1, tn minus 2, etc. U of T2, U of T1. Where, of course, each Tn is greater than the T with a smaller index. And then similarly, the propagators also factorize So I'll try and make bigger subscripts here. equal to n-fold integrals gx of t xn tn times gxn tn xn minus 1 tn is n minus 1, et cetera, down to, so this is all multiplication, g of x1 t1 x0 t0, and then we have our integration measure over dx1 dx2 all the way up to dxn.
Are your x naughts and your x dashes the same thing?
X naughts and
x prime, whatever.
X prime? Well, there's no x primes here. You
right
mean
before
over there? X prime is any of the intermediate values of x. So in this kind of a picture, the idea is that x and t without subscripts are the final point, and x naught and t naught are the initial point.
Yep.
And then all of these x's with other subscripts are intermediate values. So x prime is any of these. So the idea is you have some intermediate times, intermediate positions, and we're integrating over all those intermediate values. Yes?
Is there a reason why the factorization of G includes T and T naught, whereas the factorization of U does not?
Includes T and T naught.
In the factorization representation of G.
Oh, so, well, sorry, my endpoints have changed. So here my endpoints are Tn and T1. And so those are analogous to T and T naught. Why have I changed notation? No good reason. So, I mean, think of it this way. These are dummy variables, right? So I'm just saying this U can be expressed in terms of the dummy variables, which are the endpoints in this way. And this G can be expressed in terms of these fixed values. Sorry, these variables fill in the slots. I mean, yeah, maybe the notation would have been yeah, I'm following here the presentation in Ballantyne, and it's not obvious why he chose that notation, I agree. So what we're going to do is take the limit. We're going to take the limit as n goes to infinity, which makes delta t go to 0. And then here the explicit connection is that g of some x comma ti x prime comma ti minus 1 is equal to x prime of u ti ti minus 1. And this then is equal to x of the exponential of some Hamiltonian over the time delta t over h bar x prime. And now what we're going to do is evaluate this expression for a very general Hamiltonian form, which is a particle in potential. Yes?
So how do you get from the factor? factorization of u to the next step.
From here to here?
Yes, exactly.
So what we can do is insert the resolution of identity. So
because your x is a different x, right? I mean, for the g.
You mean just the fact that the symbol I'm using is different?
No. I mean, okay, so you define g as, what was it? Yeah, that one. Oh, right, I see.
Sorry, but no, but I think I'll answer your question anyways, because I think it's a good point I should have mentioned. So, you know, basically, thanks to the heavy-handed mathematics we did for infinite dimensions, thanks to our spectral families, we can have a resolution of the identity operator in the form integral over dx of xx is some resolution of identity. And the idea is you would insert a resolution of identity in between each u. And then each time you insert a resolution of identity, and this is a common mathematical mistake to make, you have to use a different variable x, because they're not the same, right? So so first we use xn, then we use xn minus 1, and so on. And by inserting all those resolutions of identity, that's how we get from here to here. So now we're going to take the Hamiltonian to have the form p squared over 2m plus v of x. And we're going to use the approximation that e t of p plus v of x is equal to et of p, ev of x, plus an error that's of order epsilon squared. Where's my epsilon? So as long as epsilon is small enough, we can ignore the correction term in this formula. This is goes by a lot of different names: Trotter formula, Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff identity. Basically, the key point is that now this is true exactly under what condition? Well, maybe I should not ask you it about that. I should ask you it in the context of well, let me say it this way. If t and v commuted, then this is obviously true. But because t and v don't commute, because they're functions of non-commuting operators, we can make this expansion with some approximation. And this is the error in the expansion. And when we take the limit that delta t goes to 0, the error in this approximation goes to 0. I'll just erase this for simplicity. So then we have x e to the minus ih delta t over h bar. X prime is approximately equal to x e to the minus I t delta t over h bar times e to the minus I v delta t over h bar x prime. And then what this right-hand side is exactly equal to x x prime times e to the minus I v of x prime delta t over h bar. So here, because v is an operator in the position, we're acting in the position basis, so the v operator becomes, the x operator becomes a x prime variable. And now in order to evaluate the momentum operator, or a function of the momentum operator in the x basis, we're going to use the Fourier transform relationship. So we're using the fact that xp can be expressed as 1 over 2 pi h bar minus a half times e to the I px over h bar. And then we get that x e to the minus I t delta t over h bar x prime is equal to 1 over 2 pi h bar integral e to the minus I p squared delta t over 2 m h bar e to the plus I p x minus x prime over h bar. And this is integrating over p. This is a complex Gaussian, which you can look up in tables. And I'll just state the result. So collecting terms and substituting for this integral, which I have the formula if you guys want to see it. That's we get that not really collecting terms and substituting yet, but so it's a bit of an involved expression. Remember, this is, first of all, this is an approximation, so I should write an approximate symbol here. And we're just going to call this g of, this is g of xt, x prime, here, t minus delta t. Sorry, let me write more clearly. G of x t x prime t minus delta t is equal to this expression. So the next step is to now combine terms for all these intermediate steps and get a complete formula. But it's a lot of writing, and we're out of time, so I will continue this next class. Are there any questions about what we've done so far? Yeah?
Is the assumption of Markov property used in the quantum case?
Hold on a second. Just make note of where we stop. Sorry?
I mean, say in the classical case, there's the assumption of Markov property.
Mm-hmm.
But in the quantum case, do we still use that?
In the quantum case, we don't need to make the assumption because the Schrodinger equation satisfies that property. So if I know the state vector at some time t,
yeah,
then I know the Hamiltonian, so I know the propagator, then I'll know the state vector at a time t plus delta t. But when the reason why the Markov property is important is because what Feynman did is he didn't assume the Schrodinger equation.
Okay.
So he just assumed he assumed the Markov property for some probabilistic evolution of complex amplitudes and derived the Schrodinger equation.
So is the Markov property related to the first order in time, the fact that the Schrodinger equation is first order in time?
It's a good question. So I think not, because I mean, the Markov property can be satisfied even for nonlinear processes as long as they're kind of deterministic, right? You just don't want like a hysteresis effect. Although there's some subtlety there that maybe I need to think about more carefully, because I know that when people look at the these collapse modifications of the Schrodinger equation, they become nonlinear because of basically you have to continuously renormalize the state. Yeah, I'd have to think about that. I'm not certain. But in any case, what we do know is that given that the Schrodinger equation is linear, then we have the Markov property. We do know the Schrodinger equation satisfies the Markov property. And whether that's necessarily the case that it be linear for that to be true, I don't know. So in a sense, right, so it's this, the fact that we can break up the unitary into these pieces is kind of the Markov property, but it's not an assumption here. It's just a property of the equation. Any other questions? Yeah?
Could you explain a bit more about the significance of the Markov property to derive this? What's the significance?
For the path integral? In our case, the Markov property is just the fact that we have, we can divide up an evolution into a sequence of steps, and we don't need to know here the previous, we don't need to know where the state was at earlier times. We just need to propagate it from time tn minus 1 to tn. We don't need to know anything about where it was earlier. So it's just, it's kind of a natural thing when you're used to quantum mechanics. The significance was, as I tried to mention a minute ago, that when for Feynman it was a big deal because he was not assuming the Schrodinger equation, which gives you the Markov property for free. His goal was to analyze an evolution process based on the path integral for complex amplitudes, where he explicitly had to assume the Markov property was satisfied, and using the path integral picture from the classical picture generalized to complex amplitudes, he was able to derive the Schrodinger equation. So for him it was an assumption, and for us it's just a property that follows naturally from the fact that propagating between two time points, you only require knowledge of the state at the initial time point. You don't require knowledge of the state at prior times. So when I have that picture where you have all these zigzag steps jumping from each time to each time, the idea is that the probability of it, if you're at some intermediate step, the probability of jumping to some other step doesn't depend on the previous path, just on the current location in that process.
Oh, function, may I say this is the reason why we can choose the random things each in, at each step. You don't have to consider just the trading positions.
I don't know about that. I don't know if it's the reason or not, but I mean, you can imagine a sum over histories where you don't satisfy the Markov property. So I think that it's an independent fact. I can imagine a sum over histories. There's lots of different histories, but each history depends on all of the previous locations. So I can still have a sum over the paths, even though it doesn't satisfy the Markov property. Okay, good. Well, thanks for the questions, and we'll continue this tomorrow morning.